extreme emotional disturbance and a complete loss of self-control. You heard it. And that is the argument that defense attorneys for Luigi Mangione plan to use when he goes to trial in his defense. And now people are scratching their heads, especially the prosecution, saying this guy planned this whole thing. But now you're going to tell me that he was emotionally disturbed? What is happening?
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the global phenomenon, bringing you the very best guests in all of true crime. You have to go back to December 4th, 2024, and I remember it well. That was the morning that United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson is walking down a Midtown Manhattan Avenue, not a street, but an avenue, when suddenly from behind he is shot and killed in the early morning hours outside that Manhattan hotel where he was attending a conference. This is the CEO of one of the largest healthcare companies in America, gunned down. So it was panic in the ensuing hours. A nationwide manhunt followed, ending 5 days later, and of all places, Altoona, Pennsylvania, when people spotted who they thought was the shooter from a drawing, turned out to be Luigi Mangione. And what was he doing? He was gobbling down some fries at a McDonald's. Thank God for observant human beings who said something there wasn't right. He was actually wearing a COVID mask that he pulled down, and some people thought that that was unusual, being 4 years after the pandemic. But now, for the very first time, Luigi Mangione's defense team, they have revealed what could become the centerpiece of the trial, and it is a psychiatric defense, and it is based on New York's extreme emotional disturbance law, a little different than the an insanity defense, and we'll get into that. But this changes the conversation entirely. And here, the person who is remaining unchanged, our stalwart, R. Timothy Jansen, the letter R O U R, the tan man, come to us from Tallahassee, former federal prosecutor and an excellent criminal defense attorney. Next up, got Dr. Casey Jordan. You see her on all the TVs, the YouTubes, the Instagrams, the TikToks, you name it. She's there. She's a criminologist, an attorney, and a million other things. And last but certainly not least, we've got Erin Tognetti from the great state of Idaho. I believe it is Pocatello, former criminal prosecutor and a civil attorney now. But again, used to prosecute the bad guys. So you got another amazing panel. Tim Jansen, just broadly speaking, let's start from that bird's eye view. The defense now, and it is headed by a very powerful team. Karen Friedman Agnifilo, the wife of Mark Agnifilo of P. Diddy fame, of Harvey Weinstein fame. She's also formerly very high up in the Manhattan DA's office, basically ran the shop. They are now going to say this guy suffered from extreme emotional disturbance. Your immediate reaction?
Well, they were going to lose because they were going to prove he was the shooter. So they haven't really gotten any defense. They're just going to change now. They're hoping a jury will limit what his possible sentence can be in conviction from a murder to a manslaughter. When I heard this, I thought, oh, my God, all of his fans are going to be upset because his defense is ED. Well, it's not ED. It's EED. So I think all those ladies that stand out the courtroom will feel a little better now. It's not ED, but it's EED. And he's going to have a hard time proving he was suffering from any kind of mental, the way he planned, plotted, executed, and the way he left the scene and got away with it. It's going to be really hard. So what I think is the most important thing for the prosecution is going to be jury selection. There are going to be people in this high profile case, followers, that are going to try to get on that jury and going to try to help him.
I can't even comment on that other than to say, Tim, that was brilliant comment. The EED, later on, you refer to it. I won't even say it, but you said something else that was funny. And it fit perfectly, but I'll get yelled at if I even mention it. But we go from ED to EED, which is extreme emotional disturbance, not to be confused with ED. If you don't know what that is, you can Google it. Dr. Casey Jordan, I mean, this is a guy who went to an Ivy League school. He went to Penn, very intelligent, seemingly living a normal life, hanging out with his friends. Now, we do know that, you know, mid-20s, it's things like schizophrenia that start to rear its ugly head. Absolutely no indication, as far as I know, that this guy Mangione suffers or is suffering from that. But again, his attorneys, again, Karen Friedman Agnifilo, the wife of Mark Agnifilo, and those two are about as good as you can get, notifying the court today saying, yeah, he wasn't in his right mind. Is it a day late and a dollar short right now, Casey?
I think it's all they have. And, you know, I've been kind of unpopular for saying the only chance they have is some kind of mental health defense. But unless you've got, if you've got a diagnosis before the crime that he was schizophrenic, that would be very, very helpful. But they don't. And I, you know, after the fact, they're not really going to get one unless he really suffers from it. Now, it's very important, though. I don't even consider EED, thank you, Tim, to be a mental health defense. It's totally different than the insanity defense. It has nothing to do with the McNaughton rule or even, but it's kind of a play, and this is why it's confusing, on the substantial capacity test. Got it? So when you hear about people claiming temporary insanity, it's very often kind of an amalgam of extreme emotional disturbance that made them in that exact moment not understand the nature and consequences of their act. But it has to be in the moment. I mean, the cases that I've learned, I'll have to do a deep dive on this, but years ago I was writing a criminal law textbook and I remember a case of a man who had hired a sex worker who, after they had done their trade of services, I suppose, she said not only did she insult his manhood, but she told him she had HIV and she just gave it to him and he killed her. And, you know, the jury was like, wow, talk about a double whammy in the moment. You know, he lost it. You can't just be angry. You have to be so emotionally disturbed that you fail to understand the nature and consequences of your act and you behave impulsively. You lose control. Now, how do we get a guy who takes all the time to get a ghost gun and then, you know, get his electronic bicycle and everything else and lay in wait and knows the nature and consequences of his act enough to, you know, ride away and secret himself? It's not going to work. This is a Hail Mary pass for them to try to mitigate this down to a crime of passion, involuntary manslaughter, perhaps. And I don't think it'll work, but it's kind of all they got. But I'm really curious what the event is that they're going to introduce that caused him that extreme emotional disturbance.
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting questions already. We'll get to them from SCS Nation. I would say best guess, better community, and the questions are interesting already. Aaron Tognetti, to you, you're sitting, if you're sitting in court and used to be a criminal prosecutor, is this sort of red meat? Are you gnawing and gnashing your teeth into this right away? I mean, I know prosecutors immediately after hearing this requested their own evaluation of Luigi Mangione. So what's the process for the prosecution in the immediate days here? Are they going to try to get a psychiatrist to their own to evaluate him?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of experts that do these kind of evaluations and they look for any sign that he's intentionally playing up symptoms or anything like that. So I think that the prosecution would probably be able to find a very good expert who would know exactly what signals to look for in his behavior that would suggest that he's trying to basically performatively, you know, introduce some symptoms that would somehow fit under this. The other, you know, and I've never practiced in New York, so I was reading through their rule today through the jury instruction. It's also got this reasonableness component, which I think is interesting, and I'm sure that is to prevent anybody who's you know, voluntarily gotten high and then does something terrible mm-hmm. that they're not really able to use it. But I think that Tim kind of hit it on the head with this. I think that with this guy has had, I will just tell you, just recently I was in Italy, and there was graffiti, Free Luigi, in all over Italy when we were seeing graffiti. So, I mean, the way that he's caught on, he has this very, very, what I consider anyway, disturbed sort of fan base. Who will lie, who will say they don't know anything about the case, who will say they can be fair and impartial, who will do everything they can to get themselves onto that jury. I think that the jury selection in this is going to be, I mean, I think I'm kind of happy I'm not the prosecutor on that, because it's going to be really hard to sort those sort of fanatical people out.
Yeah, the Mangionistas, they are called, at least the women who are salivating all over the EED man. And that's a whole other story. I'd like to ask Casey Jordan about these Mangionista women and their men, too, who are obsessed with him. We'll save that for a little later on. And I do want to get, because Casey dropped the McNaughton rule, which I know nothing about, and also the notion of insanity versus this EED, the extreme emotional disturbance, which we'll also get to. But Tim, this question caught my attention from Neely 888, who's in the chat very often, friend of the show, friend of mine, friend of yours. Didn't he drop out of sight, Luigi Mangione, before, and the family had no contact with him? He did do that. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously going to help the defense here. They're going to say this guy was off his rocker. He wanted nothing to do with anybody. He became reclusive. But does that, I don't know, does that meet the threshold? I know none of you, you know, Tim's not. Casey's got some psychological background to her resume. But Tim, is that going to be enough to say that he bailed on his family and disappeared for a while?
That's not necessarily going to be positive. People that commit crimes go underground, go off the grid so far.
There we go.
To get their evidence, to get their things, and they plot because they don't want to get caught in the preparation. That doesn't mean that he's lost it, right? I don't believe he's going to be able. I think his lawyers basically told him, we're going to lose. They got you on video. You shot him in the back. The gun's coming in. The best thing we can do is keep you from getting a death penalty, maybe keep you from getting life. We're going to argue that you got this EED, and hopefully we'll get a couple crazies, some young people on that jury, and they'll buy it or they'll hang it up, and maybe they'll settle for a manslaughter. And I mean, that's Tim, probably what they're going for.
Yeah. Is this a case that you would take? Is it, because it's sort of win-win. I mean, you're not expected to win this, but if you get away with the EED defense, it's a huge win, right?
Well, it kind of reminds me when Jameis Winston's dad asked me if I would be his NFL agent. Mm. I said, let me think about it. Yes. Within 30 seconds.
By the way, Tim, he was doing World Cup stuff.
I saw that. Night, he's a very funny guy.
Yeah, my son said, who is this guy? And I said, you know what? Tim Jansen knows that guy.
My favorite client. There are cases. Listen, there are big cases that every lawyer, trial lawyer, wants to get for one reason or the other. One, build up your reputation. Two, you want to have high profile, because even if you lose and you come across good, you can build a client base. And if you win, you can be the next F. Lee Bailey when he won Shepard v. Maxwell. So you can get paid a lot of money. I think there's funds paying these people. So there are lawyers will take this case, and it's not a matter of did he do it or did he not do it. And I had a call today on a client. They said, would you take that case? I said, listen, I'm not judging if the guy's guilty. Mine is to get him a good deal or get him a fair trial. Mm. Now, there are some cases I will not take that involve, you know, children. But, there's going to be lawyers that be clamoring for that case.
Mm. Tim, I'd like to take this moment to tell both the COE and my mother that I love them. And sometimes I'm a pain in the ass. And that's it. There's nothing else besides that. Just that's the only thing. Sometimes people don't say it. So here I am admitting that I am a pain in the ass. I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I want this show to be the best, and so I annoy people.
You're sucking up for Father's Day. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, is Father's Day this weekend? That could actually really, oh, thank God, save me from some stuff. G and TJ's mom. One other question for Tim. Then we're getting back to Dr. Casey Jordan. Tim, would you be able to tell if someone was just trying to get on the jury for either a conviction or an acquittal? I'm worried, you're right, that people will pretend. Again, you got the Mangionistas. You just heard Erin saying she's in Italy with free Luigi stuff, which is kind of crazy. I bet you those are American kids over there on like a semester abroad whose parents flew them over on private jets. But that's just my opinion. Tim, can you tell if, you know, if someone's going to try to get on a jury? Have you had that situation occur?
I did. I was a federal prosecutor in Panama City, and I was prosecuting a medical doctor, a local hero, and they had parades. They had fish fries, free Freddy. And when we walked in the courtroom, they had all these people with shirts on and everything. And then we picked the jury, and I kind of got to look at the people out there so I could see who was out there, mostly young people. And there was a girl on the jury, and I was like, and I had a feeling, and I asked her a question. I said, hey, is he your doctor? And she said, yes. I said, well, if he's your doctor, then you have a bias because you don't want to have to get a new doctor. And I got him off, I got her off a cause. As soon as she was released, she lifted her shirt and she had a free Freddy shirt on. And I was like, oh my God, we would have wasted all the money because she would have hung the jury. Ooh. And there was something about her. I could tell by her answers. She wasn't saying anything. She was like trying to hide on the jury, not answering anything, not volunteering anything.
Wow. Emmy Nikolov, longtime viewer, please listen to her and please consider becoming a member to support the channel. It helps us a great deal. You can like, subscribe. We've got a Patreon page. Just do it. Just do it. Like the Nike ad. And my dad used to say, for whatever reason, my dad, may he rest in peace, I love the guy. He used to like to call things. He didn't do it like... Anyway, he called Nike Nike his whole life. He never called. He never added the hard E. It was always Nike. And then I would always say it's Nike. He's like, what, Nike? Went, no, Nike. But I don't know if he did it on purpose or just to like, I don't know. But I'll start to do stuff like that with my kids just to maybe annoy them a little. Casey Jordan, to you, McNaughton, the McNaughton rule. What is that? Sounds fancy.
Not, there's a number of different insanity defenses, okay, in every state. When I teach this class, I have to look up the latest in a grid that lists all the 50 states, which insanity defenses they allow, whether they have not guilty by reason of insanity or guilty but insane, or in some states, both. And then we have Idaho, right, Erin, that doesn't allow it at all. So there are different rules that have evolved over time and with case precedent. And I wouldn't be surprised if Luigi's attorneys are trying to lay down some new precedent in New York. So the McNaughton rule is called the right-wrong test. And I believe I've got to look it up again because I don't want to be out of date. New York, I think, uses McNaughton, but also the substantial capacity test. You sometimes can choose which one you want. McNaughton is the hardest one. A lot of the southern states use it. It goes all the way back to a guy named McNaughton in Scotland who thought he was shooting the prime minister, Sir Robert Peel, but he shot the wrong guy. He shot his secretary because he was delusional and couldn't tell one guy from the other. And they sent him to Bedlam. And that was the very first insanity defense. We borrow that from English common law. CJ101, sorry if I'm geeking out on you. And we have evolved it since the 1800s. More than 150 years has been gone. I think we're coming up on like 175 years of using the McNaughton. It's called the right-wrong test. It's two-pronged. Do you understand the difference between right and wrong? And do you know that at the time you did your thing, that society, not you, understands that what you were doing was wrong? Do you understand the nature and consequences of your act? And that people will think you're wrong. I can give you lots of case studies. I mean, Texas used the McNaughton rule with Andrea Yates. And she was initially found guilty, but then she got a new trial. And on second bite of the apple, she was found not guilty under the insanity defense because She truly believed that delivering her five children to God was what God wanted her to do in that moment. And that even if the law thought that was wrong, that she was answering to a higher power that said she was doing the right thing. I actually think that was the right finding in that particular case. But substantial capacity test, and I'll try to make this quick, allows you to have a sliding scale of your capacity to understand the difference between right and wrong. It's like the jar. Is it half full of water? Is it half empty? Okay. It's not a black and white kind of bilateral yes or no question. At the time you commit your crime, were you suffering under such a mental disease or defect that it impacted your ability to know the difference between right and wrong? And this has spawned temporary insanity and the irresistible impulse tests, which some states use. Now, that is the most closest thing we have to extreme emotional disturbance, but that's not an insanity defense. Mm-mm. In case law, you've got to have a triggering event. And I don't know what they're going to do with that. It's kind of like they want the reasonableness of self-defense plus the diminished capacity of the insanity defense rolled into one. But there's no logic to that. So it doesn't work very often.
Interesting. By the way, Dr. Casey Jordan hosts the Criminal Appeal Podcast. Casey, where do we find it and when?
You're going to find it everywhere you get your podcasts. The difference between my podcast and everybody else is I'm talking about cases that I've worked firsthand in real time. So you kind of get that whole like double dipping JD, PhD, pseudo expertise on everything. But we're on YouTube too. We do visuals. So
Criminal Appeal Podcast, check it out. Judy Herbert, possibly the most generous one of them, among them, gifting 20 memberships that will be divvied out to all of you. So a huge thanks to Judy Herbert. Now, I thought they were talking about Tim Jansen here from Christy AKJ. I think most of us agree that he's a good-looking man. They are talking about Tim, but also about Luigi, the EED man. I'm curious, because I'm shallow. Do you all think that Luigi is a stunningly good-looking young man? Let me know in the chat. You know, I always like to hear from you. Aaron, to you, I won't ask you about his looks, but can you just, Brian Koberger infamously was tried in your great state, and I don't think there's an insanity defense in Idaho, but how do you see... What's your view of the distinction here with this extreme emotional disturbance versus insanity? Because I think that's what people are going to be curious about.
Right. Well, I think that Casey described it probably better than I could, but I think that there's definitely a difference. And because I immediately recognized that it's extreme emotional disturbance, that it was going to be different than an insanity defense. And it's much more it reads more like a crime of passion defense in that the extreme emotional disturbance has to be existing at the moment. And he has so many problems with this because you have to have been under the extreme emotional disturbance at the time he pulled the trigger. And it had to have been reasonable, like I said, and then it had to have been that the defendant must have had an emotional disturbance so extreme as to result in and become manifest as a profound loss of self-control. I think the issue here is, and Tim touched on this a little bit, but I mean, getting the gun, he had the silencer. He knew, I think that notebook is really going to be a problem for him, which it sounds like prosecution has already gotten in because the comments in there, he said, so let's say you want to rebel against the deadly greed-fueled health insurance cartel. Well, that's very well thought out. And all of that would have been written ahead of time. So it all doesn't really lead up because it took so much planning. So unless they have some way that they can say he had this prolonged emotional disturbance that rose to that level, he has so much planning and thought that went into it. Another comment apparently from the notebook is, what do? You whack the CEO at the annual parasitic bean counter convention. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he planned everything down to the last detail. And then he fled because he knew he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison. So then he fled the state. So this is, he just has a lot of problems. So in reading, when you read the jury instruction and the way it's going to be presented to the jury, I agree with Casey. I think it's going to be a very high bar for them to actually be able to say that he had, you know, they're going to have to show that he was under this extreme emotional disturbance the entire time he planned this murder.
Yeah, I mean, he had multiple IDs. He had the 3D printed weapon, the suppressor, and most of that is coming in. For whatever reason, it was cast as a split victory for the defense and the prosecution when that happened. We'll get into some of that in a little bit. But Tim Jansen, the consensus is that you're much better looking than Luigi, despite
being a murderer. That's nice. Thank you, people. I appreciate that.
Plus, Tim, there's a decent amount of years between you, and they're still going for Tim Jansen. So how about that?
How old is he?
26, 27. He might be 27.
40 years
now.
Between us? Yeah.
What's 40 years, Tim? By the way, Tim, you watching the New York Knicks ticker tape parade tomorrow? My dad would have loved that. Are you going to watch that?
I don't know,
Tim?
If I will. I might be watching the World Cup.
Yeah, World Cup's great. Are you into the World Cup? The World Cup's amazing. Yeah,
I played soccer for 21 years.
I did not know that. We will discuss that. So, Tim, the judge Carro, Carro, immediately upon hearing this in court, then orders the disclosure of not today, but they must disclose the specific psychiatric condition being alleged. What kind of predicament does this? I mean, for the defense to float this out there, I assume that they would have to have some diagnosis already. Or are they now like, oh, crap, now we got to get this guy to get to a psychiatrist and have them write something for us? How does this work?
I'm sure that the law requires them to give written notice to the prosecution, and the prosecution has a right to know exactly what they're going to allege, or an expert. They have a right to depose. In Florida, we have a right to depose that person. And then the state has a right to hire their own expert or a motion to evaluate Mr. Luigi Mangione. They had to give notice. I seem to recall, I think at one time, he did this because a friend or a family member did not get medical insurance, or they something set him apart. He was all upset. Someone didn't get health coverage, and he said it. I don't know if it was in his diary or something, that's what they might argue. A close loved one died or something because the medical wasn't approved. But this is clearly it's a hit. It's a murder. It looks like it was done for attention, publicity. It was not done because he was so emotionally scarred. He didn't know what he was doing. I had an NGI. I had a girl who had never been in trouble before, worked at McDonald's, went in to get her schedule, and then all of a sudden started screaming, pulled out a knife, and stabbed a customer in the back, and just kept screaming, went down the street in the grocery store and was throwing things all off the rack. I got an expert and we got an NGI because she was not acting at the time she knew right from wrong. It is hard to get to that level. It really is. And she was charged with attempted murder. She didn't kill the person, but hard.
And she got off on it, on the NGI?
She got not guilty. Well, I hire the expert that the state uses because I want a credible expert. So when they use him, so they can't say he's just some hack. And so when the prosecutor saw the report, and all the witnesses, she was out of her mind saying things she didn't, crazy. He said, I'm not going to get an expert. We'll agree to a judge trial. And then he didn't call anybody and they found her not guilty by insanity.
Interesting.
And she's doing well.
Okay. Since then. She hasn't stabbed anyone in the back.
No, she's on meds and stuff now.
Okay, good. Remind me to stay away from her in Tallahassee.
She lives down in Miami.
Oh, great. Okay, figures. Casey, you study these psychotic killers, and make no mistake, I'm going to tell you my opinion. This guy is a cold-blooded murderer and should spend the rest of his life in prison. I don't give a crap what kind of privilege he comes from or how he looks, but this comment that I just had up, this is it. Here we go, from Mellon. My son hangs with kids that Luigi went to high school with. They all say they don't know what went wrong with him. And then you've got this comment, Casey, which is what I was getting to. He's a fame seeker. That's it. I'm just curious because one of the things that you do is you talk to psychotic killers. Do any number of them commit crimes just for fame? Is that a reason? Have you ever seen that as a reason?
For attention, for sure, for the notoriety. But most of them just good old fashioned want to kill someone. And then I mean, here's the thing that most, I know this is a character of fiction, but Arthur Fleck, Joker, right? Mm-hmm. So many of my students love this movie. And remember, he had psychiatric issues and what we would call in criminological theory, anomie, which is normlessness. You know, he's trying to do everything right, but the system is letting him down. That is probably the closest kind of folk hero notion that I could apply to Luigi Mangione case. He knows that he and by the way, Tim, I was in that HBO documentary, Who is Luigi Mangione? And they spoon fed me everything. In fact, sidebar, Karen, his defense attorney, took us to task for the HBO documentary for having full hair and makeup, but mostly for having more information than she had because we found it on our own. And she was like, what about Discovery? I'm like, well, you got to ask for it. I mean, yeah. The bottom line is that when you think about Luigi Mangione, he has become a folk hero. He represented every man. And we have found no relative or direct person that he knows who actually was denied healthcare coverage in our research. But Tim, he was rabbit holing with these people. Mm-hmm. Even though it never applied to him, he had gone through some kind of spiritual, you know, Southeast Asia pilgrimage. And he That's came back right. wanting to commune with every man and be there for the common man, right? Because he grew up in immense privilege. So a few facts. I don't know for sure he ever had back surgery. I don't know that the picture of his spine that he put on social media was actually his. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a scar on his back. I've never heard from his family that it's real. Okay, just what we know versus what he says. But he was pretending all of these things or presenting these facts that he was in pain and he was communing with people who were also in pain and who were in pain and being denied insurance. He glommed onto that. I think it could have been any cause, but that was the one that spoke to him. Mm-hmm. So when he goes and murders the CEO, allegedly, he is acting as a folk hero on behalf of all of the common people who can't have insurance. This is a man who probably had insurance, but had such super wealthy gazillionaire parents that he never would have wanted for healthcare ever. So this isn't his fight. He's doing this symbolically on behalf of the common man, which he is not. So yeah, I'm sorry about my roundabout answer, but you know, when you think about who he is and what he's trying to do, think Joker, right? He is going to become a folk hero for fighting our evil society. And we're just living in an age where people love that. They want to glom onto that because they feel disempowered.
Yeah. And then there are people like Yvonne out there. I don't think she's backing them. No pun intended. But she says, I have to respectfully disagree. I've had back surgery. I need more. Insurance won't cover. But Yvonne, I don't think you're going to go on the Sixth Avenue and murder the CEO of a healthcare company because you feel that way. And that is a big difference. So, Aaron, I tried to research some of, you know, kind of the difference, and I'll stop sort of beating this horse here in a minute. But by the way, a horse just died in Central Park. The thing collapsed and died in the heat. Like, it ain't 1827. Stop with the horse carriage rides in Central Park, please. Let this horse just go live on a farm somewhere. You nuts. Insanity defense. Aaron Tognetti. With an insanity defense, the defendant claims inability to understand nature or wrongfulness of actions. And the goal is to make the defendant not criminally responsible. Here, with extreme emotional disturbance, it is the defendant accepts criminal responsibility. The defendant argues mental and emotional state reduced culpability. And then you're looking essentially for a reduction from murder to manslaughter. So that brings me to the video that there is in existence from the shooting, the morning of the shooting. I mean, you see him and, you know, all the Mangionistas and the Mangionista boys and girls are like, oh, how do you even know that was him? When they mount this defense in the courtroom, Are they even going to, are they just going to openly admit, yes, this is our client, and it was just extreme emotion?
They have to.
Do they have to do? Okay. So they Aaron, do now. Please explain that, Aaron.
Well, that was, I think, one of the things that I noticed was that this is the very first time, and Tim and Dr. Casey can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is the first time that the defense has changed tactics so drastically that it is admitting that he's the shooter.
Yes.
And you know, that, so I mean, this was a huge change for them to all of a sudden pivot to this. And, you know, I mean, they have the gun, they have the silencer, they're able to, you know, they're going to be able to match the bullet. And I think that as all of those results start piling on, they eventually have to have this, you know, come to Jesus talk with Luigi and say, look, we're if we just go this, you're going down for first degree murder. We, you know, but you have some issues and you became reclusive and you kind of got sucked into this little, you know, cult of like how you need to protect everybody and be Robin Hood and stand up for everybody else. You know, so I don't think it's going to be enough, but I think that was why this is such a drastic change, is because they've been at least proceeding as though they were going to go in there and he's not the guy, he's not the shooter, he wasn't there, he didn't pull the trigger, he would have no reason to do this. And they basically just gave up that ghost today, you know, when they made this change. So now they're going to go in there and essentially, I mean, it's not uncommon for, you know, they'll go in there and you can admit part of a case. You can admit one thing and then fight about details on another side, you know. So that certainly happens, but that is probably what they're going to go in. And Tim would know better than I. I've never done criminal defense, but my guess is that they would go in there and essentially just stage the case as he was struggling, he was suffering, he was, you know, he had basically gone down a rabbit hole of all of this and seen all of this suffering, and he lost control and made this decision. But they'll basically concede the shooting, is my guess.
You know, it really helps the prosecution, because now the prosecution can have their whole investigative team going out there getting everything that shows to contradict this and show it didn't happen this way. He couldn't have done that. And I'm sure that the lawyers got this in writing, because anytime you go on a trial and you admit part of the crime, you have to get the consent of your client. And when you go do these conversations heart-to-hearts with your client, sometimes the lawyers don't have any client control. And they get talked into going to trial like when they had a full immunity. You know, we've seen that in the Markell case. And the question is, why did the lawyer do that? What were the motives of the lawyer? You got a client that's got full immunity and you go to trial and get life. At some point, you have to protect the client from himself or herself. And I think that's what the lawyers did here. They knew they were going to lose. They told him and they said, this is the best avenue. And he signed off. And it further shows he's a smart guy.
Yeah, I'm thinking of something totally different, because we've been doing Mackenzie Shirilla, and she's got to be one of the wackiest convicted double murders I've ever seen. And Casey, I actually am curious to get your thoughts on this. You know, social media is like roughly 20 years old. I don't know exactly when Facebook started. And now, in my opinion, Mackenzie Shirilla is really kind of like the example of everything wrong with the world and social media, who's now in prison wanting to be able to stream and TikTok and sneaking on to different streams from prison. And then I was thinking about Luigi, like he's got this following from social media, and I think he was maybe on social media. Are we going to run into a whole new world of just, I don't know, like, unhinged defendants and people being convicted who are from this generation, who are going to go to prison and want to continue this addictive habit of streaming and TikToking and getting the word out while they're behind bars? It's a weird, new, not brave world.
Well, and the correctional institutions need to shut that down.
Yeah. Why are these people on tablets incessantly? Why are they allowed?
They're to a certain extent, they're allowed to communicate with family. Okay. you know, there's for so many years, stuff contraband was coming in. You know, you could get people angel dust under the stamp on your thing. I corresponded with notes to prisoners for many years. And a lot of times, you know, they're trying to find the contraband and the nudie pictures and the drugs and the envelopes and everything else. So in recent years, they've switched to like a completely electronic systems, because now you don't have anything in an envelope going into the prison, which is considered good. Now, of course, you actually sign on and you pay a small fee to send somebody an email or even a card. Good luck getting out. I mean, I do this with prisoners I'm interviewing all the time. I write to them with emails. So they need to be able to have that kind of communication that they used to have with pen and paper. That involves electronic communications. But this whole idea that you can have an iPad, I don't get that. I just don't get that at all. And I don't know if anybody ever watched Orange is the New Black, where they're smuggling cell phones in. There are cell phones in there, okay? The COs and the service providers get a lot of money to sneak those in. So number one, I think we need to pay our correctional staff a lot better. I really do, because then they will be a lot less tempted by favors from the inmates and get the respect they deserve. But beyond that, no, electronics need to be shut down. I would say that if you've got to, you know, communicate with your family, I love Florida with its sunshine laws, because then we get to see all the conversations that they have. I think every state should be recording every single conversation that an inmate has with the outside world. And I'm sorry, I'm, you know, pontificating, but if you want to have one dedicated computer with a CO standing behind it so that they can get their emails and respond to those emails, that's fine. But this whole idea, and she's just like, I'm going to model when I get out. I mean, Listen, it's great fodder, but it's terrifying. And, you know, quick piggybacking on, you know, is this something that we're going to keep seeing? Yes. I mean, ask anyone who's got kids in school. There's video game addiction. There's social media addiction. Yeah. Starts at home. Take their screens.
Any studies on this? Like, I think this is worse than nicotine. Like, I mean, and I'm guilty of this stuff. I mean, everyone is. You just go anywhere, people just have their nose in their phone. You know, it's. But when you're, you know, young, and that's like your whole social circle. And we're seeing it with Mackenzie. It's just, and the level that her mother enables her. That's a whole other issue, but. Aaron, to you, I mean, Tim just brought up an interesting point that I wanted you to just sort of add on to, if you could. So with this extreme emotional disturbance defense, they're not going to go into court, the defense, and they're not going to try to say, well, how do we even know that that was him? They're going to have to admit that was him. So what does that do for the prosecution? It seems like it gives them a ton more resources to focus on the EED part of this, as opposed to, you know, getting an investigator to, or, you know, some sort of facial imaging, you know, software to say, though, this was him. They don't need to do that because they're gonna have to admit it was him. Right, Aaron?
Right, exactly. I mean, it's so for the prosecution, I think Tim said this too, their whole job just got easier because now they have one thing to fight. And it's not, you know, I mean, normally when you put together a criminal case, you've got, you know, the police who were on the scene, and you've got the victim and what happened, and you've got any witnesses who maybe saw something, you've got anybody who knew the person and they maybe admitted something, and then you've got DNA experts, right? And you're putting together this whole crime scene investigation, you've got all of these puzzle pieces. Now they've got one thing to focus on. And it's just, now it all comes down to this one issue. So what they're going to be doing, and, you know, and like Tim was saying, depending on how much notice they've had, they may have already pivoted to this, but now the goal is going to be finding everybody who can sort of contradict this extreme emotional distress that he had, right? Everybody who can talk about, he seemed fine to me. He was normal. I talked to him this time. I mean, obviously you're going to have doctors that are going to talk about these things, but they're also going to be, you know, turning over every stone, looking for everybody who's had any kind of recent contact with him right prior to where he kind of went underground. And then maybe they're going to be, if they haven't already, they're probably doing search warrants for everybody who was still talking to online. And if he was just, you know, having those kind of communications with people about, you know, oh, these poor people who don't have insurance, or they're going through these issues, they may see that, but even that is probably not going to help him if it comes across very rational. right? Yeah. This is terrible. The whole system sucks. I'm going to take it down. That's still a very rational thought. And just certainly doesn't show that he somehow is losing control. But so now they just have this one issue, but they're going to be looking for every single person who can attest to his condition right before he kind of started planning it, and anybody he had any contact with during his planning process.
Yeah. Do we know if the same lawyers are representing him in federal court and state court? Because he just put himself in a big box, a tight box, because he's not going to be allowed to testify in this state court. Because if he testifies and goes up there and says, yeah, I did it, that's going to be admissible in his federal court that doesn't have this emotional distress issue. So he's either going and not going to testify, or the sentence in federal court could be, I don't know if they took off the death, but it's certainly life.
Yeah. If anyone knows, let us know. My understanding was that they're representing him in both, but I don't know for sure. STS will know the answer to that. I thought this comment was super interesting. And I was going to ask Casey, someone posted that in Mecklenburg, North Carolina, they now have a recording, state-of-the-art recording studio in the prison for inmates. Shout out to G and TJ's mom, who I met in New Jersey. Thank you for this. But there's some sort of state-of-the-art recording studio. We kind of got into this a little bit yesterday because we had the Dom Russo, the victim of Mackenzie Schirillo. We had her older sister on, and then we had a former inmate who works to help those who are incarcerated to be rehabilitated. I mean, Casey, this is off the beaten path here, but I'm just curious your thoughts on putting in a high state-of-the-art recording studio in a state prison. Is that a good idea to encourage inmates to rehabilitate, or is that the wrong kind of reward? What do you think?
I don't think I can emphatically say how much I disagree with this. Terrible idea. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. Okay. And I actually am a fan of educational programs I believe in a lot of assessment of prisoners. One size does not fit all. Some cannot be rehabilitated. Let's not waste our time. But those that we have indications, and I'm sorry, but the studies indicate women are far more likely to be rehabilitatable than men just because of the way we're socialized. And I have seen tremendous come from behind victories of people who've gone to prison and gotten education and gone out and led the best life. And if they're getting out, and almost all of them are going to get out, don't we want them to be successful in that? But I believe in them learning trades and getting education. But the one thing they don't need to be doing is TikTok and social media and having full-blown studios where they think they're going to be stars. You don't want to ever glorify their crimes, and attention glorifies their crimes. So yeah, I'm really big on a very vacuous, controlled environment that has opportunities to learn, to get a trade, to prepare for your release. But yeah, cut off from the outside world. You get a little class in how to reintegrate yourself just before you get out.
Yeah. I love this the comment of the night so far from Ellie Modoc. I get extreme emotional distress when I miss an STS live. You should. And I'm happy to hear that. Just don't do anything crazy while you're in there. Just come find us on the YouTube. Aaron, back to you. So the judge in a previous court ruling and hearing did allow into evidence the murder weapon, the suppressor, the notebook, the quote-unquote manifesto, and some other statements. And is that why we're at where we're at right now? You see some of the evidence. I mean, is that did the defense team, Karen Friedman Agnifilo and Mark Agnifilo, go back and speak to each other at their apartment in New York City and say, we're up the creek with no paddle. EED is our only bet because this is going to be too damning.
And that's my guess. Like I say, I was kind of following the different fights over admissibility of certain evidence. And I don't know why they thought. I would have been shocked if the court for any reason excluded the notebook, the gun, the suppressor. All of that should definitely be admissible. And I think by the time you have all of the ballistics back on all of that, you've just kind of got this sort of smoking gun. And then you hit that point where it's where the only thing they can do now is damage control. And then that's what I see this as. And it's you know, Dr. Casey said it's a Hail Mary. And that's the way I see it. I don't think their odds are very good of pulling this off. But at this point, they're just looking for any possible mitigation of his exposure.
Mm. Look, I think this might be me. On a lighter note, Waldman reminds me a little of Johnny Knoxville, but more classy. Is that, or am I not wild, man? I don't know, but interesting. I'll tell you, I know I've been whining about this a little bit, but I'm headed back to the eyeglass store because I don't know what's going on. Is it possible that my eyes are just deteriorating so quickly that I just got a prescription 5 days ago and already I can't see? I don't know, but we'll have to check it out. Tim Jansen, the prosecution story now is going to basically be, look, there was incredible planning. They're going to say he researched this, right? He went off the grid. We talked about that. He traveled. He traveled from, like, at one point he was in Hawaii. He did surveillance, target selection. He went through different healthcare CEOs. He wrote about it. He had escape routes. How the hell, with all that, is the defense going to say, is the defense going to come out and say that he was so disturbed, but yet he was able to have the wherewithal to do this? I mean, maybe I just don't understand the law. Maybe that's where my issue is. Crazy people do things. I mean, look at Ted Kaczynski. I mean, that dude was a lunatic, but about as smart as you can get. He went to MIT. Mm-hmm. So crazy people can do smart things. Is that going to be part of the defense?
They don't really have much of a defense. They're just trying to limit the damage, right? Mm. You know, they're not going to be able to say he didn't do it. They're not going to say he didn't do the planning. They're not going to say he's not smart. They're not going to say he didn't try to get away, because he did. Everything he did shows a clear intent to commit a crime and get away with it. He's not the one that was going to get caught and thought, I'm going to get killed. He didn't do any of that. Pre-planning shows intent, shows motive, and now he's going to face the responsibility. As a defense lawyer, I don't know what I would get up there and say. I don't know what they're going to argue that set him off, that make him go to this and to do this to this healthcare CEO. He better have something, or he's going to count on the jury, maybe somebody infiltrating that jury, and they get a hung jury, and then maybe they'll get a plea to a manslaughter. I think that's the only thing he can do, right, Casey?
Yeah.
You know?
That's exactly what I think their strategy is.
If you can't win, you try to fight for another day and outlast him.
Yeah,
I would just say, though, that if I was the prosecutor, no deal. I would just try it again. I mean, that's the thing, is that you don't have to make a deal. But if you get a hung jury, you can just try it again. And on a case like this, where you know that it's jury nullification, right, that you had a plant on there whose whole goal was to save Luigi, then I would try it again. And so I don't know enough about these prosecutors to know what they'll do, but I wouldn't make a deal.
You know, if they don't get a conviction and they get a hung jury or whatever, they'll find out from the jury what it was. They'll find out. Somebody will talk, and they'll find out maybe one person, and they'll retry it again. We had that with Katie Magbanawa. One juror would not find her guilty, was not going to find her guilty, wouldn't vote. It was like 11-1. And then they retried her and she got convicted, even though she had full immunity on the table.
Kerry,
decision making.
Yeah.
Good lawyer control.
STS, what a talented bunch you have on here. Not only do we have the best guest in true crime, I think we've got the best show on YouTube, period. I might sound immodest saying that, but, I don't know. We have fun with crazy, very heavy, deep topics here. And I don't know. I think it's interesting. But I mean, Aaron, just back to that point. Where do you put the chances of this actually going to trial still? I mean, so you're saying the prosecution is never going to say, OK, let's just call it manslaughter. You've got a deal. They're not going to do that. But if death is off the table, if death is, which it is, as far as I know, death is off the table. Is there any calculus where Karen Friedman Agnifilo, Luigi's attorney, is going to say, okay, let's just cut some deal? What would that deal be?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that on something this high profile, it's really hard for a prosecutor to make those kind of deals because, I mean, look at what happened with, oh my gosh, help me, Joel, the Idaho, the guy that killed the four kids.
Koberger.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, everybody lost their minds afterwards. I was considered, you know, a dragon lady as a prosecutor. And I supported that deal because it was split. Half the families were totally on board with it. I've done murder cases where the families are like, that's the easy way out. And it gives you, you know, there's appeals for the next 20 years. Even in Idaho, we have had people sitting on death where, you know, I mean, Idaho, we still have the death penalty and everything, but we have people sitting on death row for 30 years. And that's just it's a long period of uncertainty. So I supported that. But with this one, because it's so high profile, if they make a deal, there's also a really bad messaging in this one, partly because of the cult of Luigi Mangione, right? There's a whole cult out there. Like I say, when you're seeing graffiti in Italian, in other countries and stuff about, he's created like this weird movement. And the fact that we already know statistically, like our younger generation has a higher threshold for this type of violence is okay. It's justified, which really for people our age is kind of horrific. And so something is really wrong. And so I think from a prosecutor's standpoint, we need to do what we can do to shut that down just because we don't want copycats of this thing happening. Mm-hmm. This kid needs to go to prison for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, period. He needs to. And so I think the prosecutors are in a tough spot. Then again, it's a New York prosecutor. I don't know. They might feel differently and be able to make some kind of a deal. But the only deal to really make is, okay, I will agree to 20 years in prison. And I'm about to use like California, I mean, Idaho terminology. I'm licensed in California too, but in Idaho, we have a fixed portion and an indeterminate. So once you do your fixed portion, then it's up to the parole board, you know? So I've had people sentenced to like 35 to life. So they're doing 35 period. But states are different. And so with him, you know, you'd want some kind of guarantee that he's going to be doing. I mean, to me as a prosecutor, I would not make that deal. I want this guy, he needs to go to prison forever. Because like I say, more and more social media and what it's doing is that we're getting more and more of that sort of, you know, not necessarily a copycat as though you're following someone's methodology, but you're following the spirit of their crime. And we're just seeing too much of that. I mean, I think the Charlie Kirk assassination, even the last guy that ran into the White House press conference dinner, the correspondence dinner. Everything about that guy, his manifesto and everything was just it was for attention. It's these people that just feel like they need to make their life have meaning. And that's the scary thing with something like this is that we just don't want to all of a sudden see more innocent people getting gunned down because people don't like the industry they're part of, or they see them, they're able to make them some kind of a villain.
And that's why I go back to the whole social media aspect, because then I wonder if some of these crimes wouldn't have been committed if they knew that they weren't going to get the attention that they got immediately. But then you go back to like the Hinckleys and these other cases early on where I guess the same argument could be made. But yeah, the White House, the guy who tried to break into the correspondence dinner is another good example, as is Tyler Robinson with Charlie Kirk. But let me go back to Tim on this. Just a couple more things, then we'll get some final thoughts. The notebook problem, Tim. I mean, that's a big problem. The notebook shows the following. It shows motive. It shows preparation. It shows ideology. It shows intent. But now, is the defense going to come out and try to twist it and say, no, it shows OCD, obsession, fixation, deterioration, disturbed thinking? Is that what they're going to have to do? They're going to have to say, okay, you know, it's like when you look at one of those, I don't know how to say it, and my mom speaks French, so the trompe d'oeil, which is like an optical illusion. You know, you look at a photo, and if you look at it once, it's a naked woman. You look at it again, it's a whatever on the other profile, mm-hmm. like an ugly old man. I mean, are they going to have to do that? Are they going to have to paint you're looking at this notebook and they're going to tell you you're looking at something totally different.
One lawyer on that team is going to be specifically focused on the notebook, and they're going to have to find ways on cross-examination or even in jury selection.
That's interesting.
You're going to hear about this notebook. What you're going to see in the notebook, it gives another version of our client. We're going to give you that evidence. They have to take it on. If you don't, you've just given up, you know. I agree with Aaron and Casey. These crimes have got to be prosecuted to the fullest. You can't negotiate these kind of cases because you're inviting people to go out there and just shoot and kill whoever they disagree with. And a prosecutor that cuts a deal, depending on where they're elected, if they were elected in Florida, they would be thrown out of office. The prosecutor here would never do that. Now, but they're holding firm. I don't think I could even go in there and ask for a 15-year, 20-year sentence on this. I would have a hard time holding my face and saying, yeah, this is a good this is a fair resolution, because it's not. He took someone's life in cold blood, shot him in the back. He's a family man. You had nothing against him personally. And then you hid, you planned it, and now you said you've been innocent for years. You hired all this people. You got all this notoriety. And now you're saying, oh, I did it, but cut me a break. There's no reason to cut him a break.
Yeah, and I really hope they don't. I mean, I'm with Aaron on this. Yeah, this guy needs to be made an example. And by the way, in Idaho, Kevin Fixer just sent me a recent article. They're going to start using the firing squad moving forward. So that's what Koberger is eventually going to find himself in front of. But Isagul Oha used to be Aksu from Turkey, gifting 50 memberships. Very generous here. Thank you so much for that. Someone said, I think it was GNTJ's mom, which made me laugh because no one's ever called me this before. If I can find it, bear with me one second. Oh, here we go. Joel, what puts you above the rest out there is you are uniquely normal. I don't think anyone's ever called me normal till today. and many relate to you. Also a good journalist. Thank you. Maybe I'm relatable because I'm not normal. I don't know. Most people are not normal. By the way, I got a horrible piece of news, which I wasn't planning to even mention, but I come from a very small town in New Jersey. We're super tight-knit, all know each other. And then last night, someone messaged one of our friends is no longer with us. He had moved to Seattle. He was out of a job. He was not married. He did not have children. He was kind of alone in the world. His mother died when we were probably in seventh grade. I've known him since the 70s. And apparently he took his own life. So if you are really struggling, it was the landlord looking for his rent that found him. But if anyone is really struggling, just you can ask people for help. I wish he came to us. We had kind of all been in touch on Facebook a little bit. There's always another answer out there. So I don't know what made me think of that, but maybe because I'm not normal made me think of that. But anyway, rest in peace, Jonathan Pollock. Great guy. Sad. It's weird because you remember moments in time, and we used to hang out in his attic in the 80s and listen to music before we went out to high school parties. And now it's a different world. It's sad. Now that I've depressed everyone, back onto Luigi Mancione. Sorry, it was, we're all like stunned about it.
Your therapy session.
Yeah. So, Tim, let me come back to you. I mean, just about the specific condition here. So, again, the judge said, look, you're going to have to give us a diagnosis, and the defense hasn't revealed it. And maybe this is why I brought it up, because my notes, the first thing it says is depression. Possibilities here include depression, chronic pain issue. And you heard Casey Jordan say he might not even have had back issues. We don't know that for sure. Anxiety disorders, personality disorders. I mean, I don't know how to ask this in a smart way or in a subtle way, Tim, but when you go to an expert, do you have to leave it like open-ended, or are you nudging the expert to say, it would sure be great if you gave us a chronic pain diagnosis here that caused, you know, or do you have to give it to the expert and let the expert do what the expert does?
Well, this goes to the ethics of the lawyer and the ethics of the expert. There are experts out there that will say whatever you want them to say if you pay them. There are lawyers that will hire that lawyer because they know that they'll say whatever they want. I do not do that. No client is worth my ethics and my practice. I tell every expert, you do your evaluation. Don't give me a written report. Give me a verbal report. And if it's good, then you give me a written. Because if it's bad, I got to turn it over to the prosecution and he becomes a witness for the state. But no, I try to hire the expert. Like we have Florida called Jimmy Rice. And they can civilly commit somebody's sex offense for the rest of their life, even after. And the state hires this one expert. They use them all the time. So I always use him to do my evaluation. So if it's good, the state goes, okay, we're not going to impeach our own guy we use all the time. So, but there are experts out there that will say, and I've had a guy say one time, hey, what does it need to say? I said, no, we don't do that. That's not what we're doing here. We want just an objective evaluation. But there are lawyers that do that. A lot of them are personal injury lawyers.
Yeah. By the way, thank you,
Gene. I'm not naming any, but.
Yeah. I was going to name someone. I can't. This is a great point. Koberger did cut that plea deal. No, firing squad for Koberger. But you know what? I think that guy's already lost his mind. And in a lot of ways, I think it's worse to just be sitting in that little box, which is what he's doing for the very rest of his life. I mean, just imagine that guy is confined 23 hours a day and I saw that cell with my own eyes, at least that cell block, because we got a tour. I just can't imagine.
Give any sympathy to him.
No, I just cannot. Oh, my God.
No sympathy.
For that, if anyone deserves it, it is that.
That's right.
Casey Jordan, one more thing, and then we'll go around and get final thoughts. So part of this extreme emotional disturbance, there's this facet known as profound loss of self-control. This guy bought equipment. He bought travel tickets. He surveilled. He planned it. What does that even mean? Profound, but according to the law, I don't even know in regular terms, what does profound loss of self-control mean? I mean, how do you define that? How do you delineate that in a courtroom?
You're going to do it with cases that serve as precedent. And by the way, I think they are trying to redefine what the terminology means with this case. Happens all the time. It happened with the Twinkie defense insanity. It happened with Hinckley. We started with McNaughton rule, and now we have three or four other insanity defenses. We can come up with, based on case precedent, a new definition of profound loss of self-control. Now, when I taught this in criminal law, I'm going to use a hypothetical. It's from the movie Seven. At the end of this movie, Brad Pitt. Sorry, I'm focusing again. Brad Pitt, and if you've never seen the movie, it's just, you know, it's like a cult classic. Spoiler alert, he has the serial killer at gunpoint. He's a cop, and a motorcycle comes up and delivers a box while he has this guy in the desert with a gun pointed at his head. And what's in the box? He starts screaming, "What's in the box?" Well, the serial killer who wants him to kill him says, "It's your wife's head. I got her. I killed her. She begged for the life of her and your unborn baby." Okay. So now you just found out this man killed your wife, cut her head off, and that she was pregnant. He shoots the man in the head. Everyone's cheering. Okay. Everyone's like, nobody could hear that news and not pull the trigger. Okay.
Right.
So that would be a really good example of extreme emotional disturbance based on a profound lack of self-control that to the average Joe is reasonable under the circumstances. We don't have that here. I think they're going to try to redefine that profound loss of self-control as a straw in the camel's back situation. And that it took place over months while he was rabbit holing and he thought he was the champion of the people. And he got all obsessed with CEOs and bad, big insurance companies. And that the profound loss of self-control was a journey of 1,000 steps that resulted in the shooting of the CEO. I think they're going to try to say it doesn't have to be a triggering event that happens seconds before the shooting. It could be a slow boil. I think that's going to be their technique. They're going to see. And I really do think that they're just trying to get him 3 years based on involuntary manslaughter, that they're going to be looking for that juror that's not a stealth juror, but somebody who has to look at the direct evidence, know he's guilty, but still kind of feels for his cause. Yeah. So,
which I hate to say it, but in New York City, that could happen.
That could happen. That could happen.
So it's not happening in Idaho. Yeah. Much less.
Not Florida.
Yeah. Not in Florida, not in Idaho, but New York City.
It happened in Manhattan. The panties are flinging at him. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Just takes one.
Joel, if I saw somebody hurt a dog in front of me, my dog, I would obviously lose it and take that person out.
Don't mess with Tim Jansen's dog. I'm with you, Tim, on that. My kids?
Kids, too. I mean, yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know, but dog, 100%. Erin Tognetti, she is a former criminal prosecutor, a civil attorney from the great state of Idaho. I'd like to live in Idaho. Clean air, not everyone in your face. It's must be nice in Pocatello, Idaho. Erin, in this case, your final thoughts, but how do you make sure that the jurors here are focusing on the person to the point we were just talking about and not the CEO? Like, you have to, how do you pull the human being, the father of two, the husband, all of these things, and make sure you're not looking at an evil healthcare CEO?
Well, and you're going to have, I mean, you know, I think character witnesses go both ways. And so, you know, that's obviously going to be important, is to constantly be reminding people about, you know, that this was a person, that this was a father, and he was doing his job. And you can not like the system and the healthcare system and how much CEOs make, but it's not like any of those people wouldn't have taken his job if they said, hey, we'll pay you $5 million a year if you come be CEO. They would do it too. So it's kind of one of those. It's just not really like a fair comparison. But so you have to kind of definitely humanize the victim. I mean, you always have to anyway. You know, people need to be reminded that this isn't about, you know, this one man's grievance against the entire industry. This is about a husband and a father who was, you know, I don't know if he was well liked at work, but things like that. But you're going to want people to be able to talk about how important he was and how dedicated he was and how hard he worked. And then, you know, that he was a dedicated family man. And you obviously need to remind people of that, I think, over and over again, just because Luigi has become this kind of larger than life figure. And so that will be something that you're up against, I think, during the entire trial. But I think that really what it's going to kind of come down to, like I say, I just hope, since I'm not the prosecutor on it, I just really hope that the prosecutors out there hang strong, because this is a case. I mean, I think we're going to see backlash if he gets life. There's still going to be, right, that cult out there who's like, he had it coming. But I think it's so scary. I just hear too many stories, right? He had it coming. And they justify these kind of things so much that we have to show, well, these are the consequences. You're not Robin Hood. You're not stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. You're taking the life of an innocent man to make a statement about an entire healthcare industry that you don't approve of. I mean, it just, so because of that, it's my final thoughts. I mean, I really hope that they stick to it and that he gets the absolute maximum and that they're able to properly vet that jury. Because like I say, I think that's going to be one of the really tricky things, is being able to spot the phonies in your jury pool who are going to be saying all the right things. That's the thing you have to remember. They're going to intentionally say all the right things. Murder is never justified. There's never a reason for that. No, I've never had anybody in my family, you know, have to file bankruptcy because of healthcare expenses because they had no insurance, right? You got to vet all of those people out, but there will be people who do have a chip on their shoulder or are part of the Mangione cult, and they're going to be doing everything that they can to really to bluff their way onto that jury. And that's the biggest concern. But like I say, this is just, it's too important. I think it's too important fundamentally to really our country for them to make a deal on this one.
All right. Thank you for that explanation. Thank you to Aaron Tognetti for being here. Dr. Casey Jordan, the Criminal Appeal Podcast, you better check it out. It's on the YouTube. It's wherever you listen to podcasts. She is a criminologist, an attorney, a behaviorist. She's a smart woman who knows a lot about awful people, otherwise known as killers. Dr. Casey Jordan, your final thoughts here. I don't really have a final question, but I'm just, you know, New York City is known to be a very sort of, and I lived there for many years, liberal, empathetic place. I don't know how hard it's going to be to get just one juror who's sort of one of these Mangionistas to say, yeah, I don't want to convict this guy to a life in prison, you know, you know, he was either at a bad place in his life or he was fighting for a good cause. I mean, how do they prevent that?
Well, first of all, you can have a plea agreement. It's not really a negotiation where we skip the trial and they get the max sentence. We saw it with Koberger. Well, they took death off the table, but it's been 20 years since anyone was executed in Idaho. So that seemed unlikely to start with. But how about just today we had the Gilgo Beach murderer, Rex Yuerman, sentenced, and he pleaded to 8 murders. We skipped the trial and the FBI gets to interview him, which I kind of like. I would like to see them come and say, let's put the kibosh. It won't happen, but wouldn't it be nice to just see him take life? We get to skip the trial and we just put the kibosh on all of the attention seeking publicity, you know, revolutionary, he's our folk hero nonsense, because I really don't want this to be a circus. And my final thoughts are that, you know, I've only defended a few murder cases and they've all been mental health issues. But the number one thing I do is sit second chair and I'm the jury analyst. That's when my PhD kicks in. And the thing is, the defense will absolutely have a thin slicing jury consultant sitting there. There's no doubt in my mind. Prosecution doesn't get to hire them, but they need that same thing. They need somebody who's looking only at the jury.
It's going to be Josh Dubin Jansen, the guy that did the Adelsons. He's a big New York City guy. He's very well known and he's very expensive. And God, Tim, I want that job.
I'll volunteer. I'll do it for them. Okay. I'll sit here and I'll give them tips.
But Casey, how hard is it? I mean, when you're doing that as a jury consultant, I mean, you're working off of instinct. What are you looking for there to make sure you've got the right jurors?
I get that question all the time, you know, and I just came from CrimeCon and I met with the 4 guys from the behavior panel. And that was like, whoa, because all we do is thin slice people. Right. And it just takes years of practice. Yes, you can learn all the stuff about the body language and read the books and all that. But practice is the only way you get at it. It is academic, but it's 50% intuitive. And it is based on seeing, you know, if you read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, you understand about how the thin slicing works. You get to the point where you watch video of people, you can isolate their facial expressions and their tics and zone in on that. And when you've done it a few thousand times, you don't need to watch video anymore. You can just see it in real time. So that's what your jury consultants usually do. They have years and years of not just studying micro expressions and body language, but they can recognize it in real time. And it's highly intuitive. Okay. There's no textbook for this. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But your case is won or lost in jury selection. That I know. Mm-hmm.
Tim Jansen, the man who, made an analogy between extreme emotional disturbance and erectile dysfunction that will never leave me. And I'm going to pick that as a clip for tonight's show on social media because I like that clip. Tim Jansen also does not live on the beach, but he sure looks like he does because he is tan like George Hamilton. Looking good, Tim Jansen. Tim, also, the COE pulled me aside today and said, relax now, because coming up in August, Shanna Gardner's on trial. There are like 4 trials back to back that STS is going to cover. Tim, it's a little bit of a ride for you, Jacksonville, but are you going to come hang out with me for a day or two for Shanna Gardner?
I will be at my farm in New England.
Oh boy!
July and August, so I can do shows.
End of August.
I'm there until September, from all July and all August, first week of September.
Can I come to your farm and do the show from there instead?
You can. We'll have a great time, and lobster's on me.
And can I bring my 3 children?
Yeah, you can. We got room. They'll like the farm.
They love Uncle Tim. All right, we'll see. I just invited myself to Cape Cod, everybody. Tim Jansen, how does this all end? Is this going to go to trial? And the interesting point that Tim brought up is the nexus between the state and federal case here. That's going to be very tricky because I think it's going to get tried in both jurisdictions.
It's in October. It's after the state trial, which is rare because normally the federal trials always go first and the state takes a back door. So
yeah, why is it happening that way here in your final?
I think the feds agreed to let the state go first. And I think it was a smart move.
Yeah.
Usually it's the opposite. You get a federal sentence and then the state decides if they're going to do anything, run a concurrent, or you got so much time in fed, we're just going to dismiss. I wish that the jurisdictions would sequester juries. I'm concerned cases like this and other assassination cases, you need to sequester that jury. Because there's going to be people out there, and even the Karen Reed case probably should have had a sequestered jury. Because there was so much publicity, animosity, people, and now with social media, they'll find out who these jurors are, they'll trace them home. And we need to protect the juries, we need fair trials, and we need prosecutors to, you know, do the right thing, because these vindictive people that go out and, I don't like what you said, I'm going to shoot you and kill you. We can't have to stop it because no one's safe. Nobody's safe.
Very well said. Another amazing panel. Aaron Tognetti, Dr. Casey Jordan, the famed Tallahassee criminal defense attorney, R and the OUR.
See you on the Cape.
Yeah, see you on the Cape. Thank you all for being here. Everyone have a safe, nice summer. Be kind. Don't murder anyone. We're back tomorrow. Love you all. See you then.